Generations Radio broadcast. My name is Kevin Swanson, coming to you from my basement out here in the Eastern Plains of Colorado as we broadcast during the waning years of the Western world, the breakdown of the United States Republic, the breakdown of faith, family, and freedom in the Western world. The statistics bear it out, so we don't have to bring it out every single time. Those of you listening to the show, you know that 42% of kids are born outside of wedlock, up from 6% in 1960, and half of marriages end in divorce. And America's in $100 trillion of debt and unfunded liabilities. And it does appear that we're looking at a birth implosion where the worker to retiree ratio will be one third of what it was in 1950, 20 years from now. So with all of this put together, we're asking, what are the fundamental solutions to these issues? And we're offering them from God's word. We really believe the Proverbs would be a really good place to start if you were, say, raising children in the 21st century. If there's anybody listening who's raising a child in the 21st century, what would you do to prepare them for 2040? I would suggest you give them the book of Proverbs and the book of Psalms, the book of Matthew, and then Mark, Luke, and John. I would suggest you start there and you take it really seriously. Because whatever the world has done, and however they've done their schools, their education, and their social systems, they're really, really, really messing up. Okay? They're really messing up. And that's a no-brainer. That's a no-brainer. If they were to be very honest with you, not on the evening in which they're drunk, but in a sober moment. If you had somebody who was sober, an economist who was sober, and he was going to be very, very honest with you, he'd say, we're in big-time trouble. Here is an article from CNSNews.com. In fact, CNSNews.com has had several articles I'm going to go over in this edition of the program to update you on where we are. Just trying to state us where we are in the decline of the American socioeconomic system. And right now, Steve, we have a record 92,269,000 people in America not in the labor force.
That's a lot.
That's right. It's 62.8% of Americans do not work.
Wow.
And that's a record. Goes back to the 1970s. 62.8% of Americans do not work. And I'm getting tired of it. To be honest with you, Steve, I'm getting tired. I've been wondering for a while why I'm so tired. My wife had told me that it has something to do with my physical condition. Maybe a little too much pressure on the job. But I finally figured out the real reason. I'm tired because I'm overworked. The population of this country, what, 237 million? 104 million are retired, leaves 133 million to do all the work. I just said that 92 million aren't working. They're in school or whatever. And that leaves 48 million to do the work. Of this, there are 29 million employed by the federal government and at least 19 million to do all the work. 2.8 million are in the armed forces. That leaves 16.2 million to do the work. Take away from that, 14.8 million people work for state and city governments. That leaves 1.4 million to do the work. Any given time, there's 188,000 people in hospitals, leaving 1,212,000 to do the work. Now, there are 1,211,998 people in prison. That leaves two people to do the work, Steve.
That's me and
you and me, and I'm getting tired of doing it all myself.
No wonder I'm not sleeping.
I'm so tired. Okay, the statistics aren't all accurate there, but
right.
You get the idea. You know, people should be working. I don't know who all these people are, the 92,269,000 people. I don't know who these people are, but they should be working. And my guess, there's probably 5 million people who are less than 6 years of old age. And I understand why they're not working, but why isn't a 10-year-old working? What's up with a 14-year-old?
Yeah.
There's probably 111,000 people in hospitals. I understand that. I understand why they're not working.
Yeah.
And it turns out there's only about 2 million people in America who are working for the federal government. I didn't realize it was that low. It's only like 2 million working for the federal government.
Yeah, but there's a lot of them that are getting checks from
the
federal government.
We're going to talk about welfare in just a moment. Yeah. Welfare numbers are at their maximum right now. And by the way, we're not in a recession. It's hard to believe, huh?
Really?
I don't get this. I don't get this. If we have the highest percentage of people not working in the history of the country, virtually, at least for the last 40 years, and we're not in recession? Explain that to me. What are we doing? Living on debt?
Yeah, printing money.
lots and lots of money.
Yeah.
Until there's nothing that money can buy. And the gods of the copy book heading said, you don't work, you die.
Right.
Okay, Steve, you're supposed to be able to finish that.
Sorry, I haven't memorized.
Okay, all right, good enough. Yeah, they're I guess the last 20,000 people working are printing money.
Probably
that's what's happening.
Yeah,
and the other two are doing a radio show on it.
That's right.
That's us. We're commenting on it. Okay, my friends, everybody should be working. You say there's no jobs. Problem is there are no jobs. Hey, when the Pilgrims came to America, there weren't any jobs,
That's right.
There was a lot of work to do. A lot of work to do.
Yeah.
There's always work to do. And here's the deal. This is what I'm telling people. I'm telling people, prepare your sons and your daughters to work, not to get a job. Prepare them to work. Now, what does that mean? That means to wake up on Monday and say, well, there's work to do around here. Not what can I do for a dime, or what can I do for $4 an hour, or what can I do for, what is it now, $10.75 minimum wage?
Whatever.
Not to say any of that. No. When that 9-year-old, 10-year-old, 14-year-old gets up in the morning and he says, there's a lot of work to do here, Dad. I'm going to get started. And he's out there splitting wood. You never asked him to. He's just splitting wood. That's a good sign. That young man will probably survive the Great Depression of 2042. You follow me here?
Oh, yeah.
If we have trained our young people to have in the initiative to work, not to get a job, to work. See the difference there, Steve?
Oh, yeah. There's a big difference between work and job.
Yeah. And I think part of this is initiative. The other part is flexibility and innovation. Now, friends, I'm giving you the secret as to how your kids are going to survive the Great Depression in 2042. So listen, initiative number one, that is getting out of bed and going to work. One thing we tell somebody, if there's nothing in your house, then go down to a McDonald's down the street and just start washing the tables. Just wash the table, you know. Just wash, and then move on to the Chick-fil-A and wash the tables. You know, and then after that, move on to the Subway. Wash the tables at Subway. Okay? And just work through all of the fast food restaurants in your little town. Okay, after a while, you're probably going to get a few bucks for it.
Oh, yeah.
But initiative is number one. Number two, flexibility. And number three, innovation. Because, see, markets are changing. Where there are no jobs is simply a situation in which the people who are trained to do A, B, and C no longer have the opportunity to do jobs A, B, and C because jobs A, B, and C no longer exist. And if they had innovation and flexibility about themselves such they could adapt to the market needs, they would be just fine.
Right. So case in point with the Industrial Revolution, when combines came out, we didn't have too many people needing to go out and use scythes to cut down the wheat. But when the combines came out, we needed people to build them, repair them. We needed gas stations. You know, there are all kinds of new jobs, new opportunities.
All the time.
And so there's always,
all the time,
with innovation, there's always a time of economic downturn because a lot of people will lose their jobs, but then they learn to do the new things that support the new technology.
At the very least, if there's ever a Great Depression, you could write a book on how to survive this Great Depression, and there would be a market for that.
There would be.
You follow me here?
Oh, yeah.
It's the old, life gives you lemons.
Make lemonade.
All we're talking about is raising kids with three things: initiative, flexibility, innovation. You'll be just fine. The people that will be in trouble will be the people that got a job. They never really learned how to do anything in the marketplace. Okay, never had good mentorship, didn't become good entrepreneurs, didn't get training in innovation, flexibility, and the application of knowledge to life, okay? They didn't get good life-integrated learning in schools, as we've talked about many, many times in our educational theory classes, ergo, homeschool introductory workshops. But here's a guy who's working, in some tiny little cubicle in a company of 28,000 employees, and what he does is he takes one stack of papers and he moves them to another stack. And he works on one little tiny widget, one little aspect of a very large engineering project, and that's all he can do, and that's all he's done for the last 25 years. That guy's in trouble.
Yeah.
Why? Because he's not trained to innovation and flexibility. The smaller companies will always do better because there's you got to be way more flexible, way more innovative. So typically people in smaller companies will do the best, and people who have not learned to slug it out and just be really, really sluggardly in large corporations where they are largely missed for years and years and years and years because nobody really knows what they do.
Yeah. So
I worked for companies like this. When I was in college, worked for Federal Electric Corporation, ITT division, a huge company. And there were guys in my division. I tell you, Steve, they didn't do anything. All he did, this one guy, all he did was fill out his time card every 2 weeks. And I just sit there and watch him. Every day, he just kind of keep working the 8 hour on the day. Just working the eight, you know, the double zeros?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just working the double zeros every day. Now, that guy is going to be in trouble if there's ever a Great Depression. All right, friends, just a few hints as to how to train your children for work. And we may talk about this a little more as we break. First, after we come back, we're talking about the most socialist states in America. You'll be surprised. The most socialist states in America. Wow. This is going to knock your socks off. Be back in just a moment. This is Kevin Swanson. The program is Generations.
For thousands of years, families would work together in the fields in a family economy. Little boys would plow the fields next to dad, and everybody would help with harvest. Pickin' time. Well, now youth unemployment and underemployment rates stand at 80%, double what it was in 2001, two recessions ago. Unemployment and underemployment for college graduates exceeds 50%. And 70% of young men are not grown up by 30 years of age, up from 30% in 1970. Back in 1930, 70% of 15-year-old boys were still working on the family farms. Now they play computer games until they're 30 years old. No, make that 35. The family economy has virtually disappeared in the last 50 years, but we're bringing it back. Generations with Vision is sponsoring family economics conferences all over the country. In 2014, we're sponsoring conferences in Denver and Kansas City, Missouri. We're getting together with thousands of families to talk about family integrated economies, mentoring your sons and daughters in business, and trusting God to provide the increase. Register today at FamilyEconomics.com.
We're back on the Generations Radio Broadcast. Kevin Swanson here, your host. Also, Steve Vaughn in studio with me today as we talk about the socioeconomic situation in the United States of America, why this is important for all 100 nations tuning into our radio program. The reason it's important is because we are the largest domino in the international market. We are, what, 43% of the gross world product? We are huge, friends. We are a very large domino. So if America comes down, you're coming down too.
Right.
It's going to affect everybody. In fact, somebody was telling me that Uganda has still not recovered from the 2008 recession. You say, what 2008 recession? Our 2008 recession.
Wow.
Yeah, Uganda is still suffering from the 2008 recession. Listen, friends, what happens in America really matters. And so it turns out right now, handwriting's on the wall. We are at the lowest level yet in terms of participation rate in the labor force, probably largely due to the fact that our young people aren't growing up and they're not getting jobs. The worker to retiree ratio is in the pits. It is.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to be one third of what it was in 1950, 20 years, or now 10 years from now. I've been saying that for 10 years.
Yeah.
10 years from now. It's in the pits, friends. And if that be the case, then the millennials aren't working, and the people who can work aren't working, what in the world is this going to do for the retirees, the 80 million baby boomers retiring over the next 15 years? Wow. This is going to be an interesting collision. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Let's step back and watch this thing, because you're not going to see something collide like this.
Yeah, your Social Security taxes are going to go way up if something doesn't
change. We'll see. Okay. Yeah. Now, here's a summary of the most socialist states in America. This is thestreet.com. My dad sent me this, I think, last week. The most socialist states in America by state governments, okay, by how much the state governments spend, okay? Shocked me. Listen, number one, most socialist state in America. Now, these are states that are controlled by legislatures. And the legislatures are elected by the people. And the people decide whether or not they're going to elect liberals or socialists or conservatives. Okay? It turns out the most socialist state in America by state government is West Virginia.
Wow.
I know. Big wow. Crap, West Virginia. And here, they consume 34% of the state's GOP.
Wow.
That's unreal.
That is
unreal.
Crazy.
Alaska is second at 24. Now we say something about these. Wyoming is third at 22%. Mississippi, fourth at 20%. Arkansas, fifth at 19%. So the five most socialist states in America happen to be solid red states, friends. They voted Republican the last four elections. This is not the pink states. This is not half blue, half red. These are solid red conservative states. They are all socialist to the core. That's amazing. Steve, I could not believe. Now, it turns out Texas is the least socialist state in America by spending. And if you're looking at 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, you're looking at Vermont, New Mexico, Hawaii, Rhode Island, Wisconsin. So, yeah, you know, some of the liberal states, some of the blue states do pick it up eventually. But, wow, the five most socialist states in America happen to be red states, solid red states. Now, why? And the reason is, here's the reason. The reason is because they're not principled conservatives. These are not principled states. Okay? They're not principled states. You thought they were conservatives. They're not. Now, if you think you are a certain way, but it turns out you're not that way. You talk a good talk. You talk a good game. You act like you're a certain way, and you turn out not to be that way. Then you got to conclude these people are big fat hypocrites. Isn't that the definition of hypocrisy?
Yeah.
That is the definition.
Pretending to be something
that you're not. Yeah. So these are not principled conservative states, friends. West Virginia, Alaska, Wyoming, Mississippi, and Arkansas. Not principled states. Okay. You have something of a facade there. You have something of an impression that they're kind of conservative. They're not. They're not conservative. It's an impression also of independence. But Steve, you know what? They're probably big on welfare, especially states like Mississippi and Arkansas. Big on welfare. Alaska's big on welfare. These people crank in the welfare checks like nobody's business. So I have an impression of being independent. I think they're independent, but a lot of times people pretend to be independent. Independence, by the way, or individualism is not biblical.
Right.
Right? Covenantalism is biblical. The family structure is weak in these states. You'll find that these states have the highest divorce rates.
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah.
These are the states with the highest divorce rates as well. So states that claim to be independent, but they're not fighting for the family, they're not pro-family, the family structure is weak, feminism is strong in these states. By the way, Wyoming is the feminist capital of America. Cheyenne has a whole monument to feminism. It's a big deal. Feminism's a huge deal in Wyoming. So where feminism is strong, divorce rates are high, family structure is weak, and you have the weaky impression of independence, and they're the cowboy, individualist, libertarians. Give me a break. They ruin their families right and left because they're individualists as states. And libertarians always turn out to be socialists when they refuse to strengthen the family and build strong family economies. When it's pure individualism and feminism is encouraged by these individualist libertarians and they refuse to build strong marriage on a biblical covenantal concept, libertarians always turn into socialists. Ayn Rand always turns into Karl Marx. All she needs to do is turn around and the flip side of her head is Karl Marx's face.
Yeah.
Ayn Rand and Karl Marx, same deal, friends. It's always the way it works, unless you build a biblical covenantal structure, a biblical social structure, which happens to be built upon strong families.
Yeah, libertarianism has its roots in humanism, and that man is the, you know, the source of his destiny, and that man can decide everything. That's where libertarian comes.
Yeah, yeah. And Ayn Rand's anthem presents me as the god, and I worshipped I at the end of anthem, Ayn Rand's book. Pure individualism, and it ruins societies, friends. Okay? Bad, bad juju. Okay, now I've got one more set of data. Welfare in America is now reaching the threshold in order to accomplish total socialism, okay? So we've been waiting for this moment for a long time. It's now 49.5%, Steve. We've reached the limit. We've reached the point, the tipping point. Isn't that what they call it, the tipping point? The threshold at which America becomes the National Socialist States. Here we are, friends. Welfare numbers at the critical point. 109,631,000 Americans lived in households that received benefits from one or more federally funded means-tested programs, according to the 2012 fourth quarter Census Bureau. The Census Bureau is now saying 35.4% of all peoples living in America are on welfare. 35.4%. Now, if you include everybody living on government benefits of some sort, the number goes from 110 million to 153 million total benefit takers at the end of 2012, equaling, and here it is, 49.5% of the American population is government dependent right now. We are at 49.5% of Americans get their Benny check from the government. That includes Social Security as well. So welfare, 110 million. Everybody getting that government check, they are dependent on a monthly basis on the government, 49.5% of Americans. We're crossing the threshold right now. If you kick in the 7%, the 22 million working for state and federal governments, that tips over to 57% of Americans get their paycheck from the government, and I wonder how they're going to vote.
Yeah.
You follow
me?
It's where we're at. We're at the point where 49.5% of Americans on welfare, 57% get a check from the government. 57% get a check from the government. How are they going to vote? Come on. How are they going to vote? How are they going
to
vote? How would you vote?
Vote.
How would you vote? You would vote more money from the 43% in order that you get a pay raise. The only way you're going to get a pay raise is if you can get more money out of the 43% who are producing, such that the 57% will continue to vote in order to gain more money out of the 43% who are still producing something across America, and out of the 43% producing something, what, 92 million not in the labor force? I don't know how many are left. I guess it's maybe 16 million still producing something in America. We're at the point now of no return.
Yeah.
Steve, I don't know what happens after this. 82 million Americans are welfare takers on Medicaid, 51 million on food stamps, 22 million on WIC, 20 million in households on supplemental security income, 13 million lived in public housing, 5 million got temporary assistance to needy families, 4.5 million received other forms of federal cash assistance.
One of the best ideas I think I've ever heard on the radio as to how to solve this problem is to change the way who can vote. So the people who can vote are the net taxpayers, and if you are a net tax receiver, you lose your right.
I've got it. Let's do initiative referendum and see if the 57% will vote for that.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Nope.
No, they're not going to vote for that. No, that's too late.
Should have done that a while back.
Should have done that 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's too late now for that. Oh, yeah, we're done for. This is the end, friends. This is the way it looks at the end. At some point, after robbing Peter to pay Paul, there's nothing that money can buy. And the gods of Cabo Bucetti say, if you don't work, you die. Get the poem, friends. The poem's worthwhile. Train your kids in some of this stuff, because if we're ever going to get an opportunity to rebuild a society somewhere, a socioeconomic system that's healthy and able to reproduce, you're going to need some basic good sense. And I'd encourage you to start with the Book of Proverbs, because if you ever get a chance to rebuild a socioeconomic system, Book of Proverbs would be a really good place to start. That's why we did our Proverbs Bible study guides. We got 3 Proverbs Bible study guides in order to provide a core curriculum for hundreds of thousands of parents who still want to salvage something of character and a Christian biblical world and life view and a biblical socioeconomic system. If you want to salvage something like that, and you want biblical wisdom that's been around for a very, very long time, get out the Book of Proverbs. You don't need to study guides. But if you'd like a little extra to help explain, help to apply, and help to draw in illustrations, present-day illustrations to these wonderful lessons that have been around for 3,000 years, get copies of the Proverbs Bible study guides at our website, generationswithvision.com or kevinswanson.com. You know, tied into this, Steve, is the massive, massive destruction of the social system. You know, we just talked about economics. Why aren't 93 million people working? Why are 154 million people on welfare? You know, on and on and on. What's going on? Where do we go wrong? You know, what happened? A lot of this is related to social issues. Here's Christian Institute, Christian.org. It's a UK Christian site referring to some secular studies, couple of secular studies done in the United States, where these studies have looked at divorce and concluded there's no such thing as a good divorce.
I would agree.
Yeah, finally. Yeah, yeah. The experts are in.
Yeah.
The word is in. They've put another $17 million into studies, and they've come up with exactly what the Bible says.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
So maybe we should have started there, but
yeah.
Wow. This study looked at 270 parents divorced or separated between 1998 and 2004, and it has been a nightmare for every kid. The study found that children of divorced parents more likely than others to have behavioral problems, mental health difficulties, and were at a greater risk of performing poorly at school. They also referred to a study at Pennsylvania State University. Researchers found the same thing. They looked at 1,000 families, found that children with divorced parents suffer even if the split was amicable. On and on it goes. They suffer on all kinds of different levels. Despite the expectation that children fare better if their divorced parents develop a cooperative, co-parenting relationship, the authors found that parents' reports of their children's internalizing and externalizing behaviors, their social skills, did not significantly differ by type of post-divorce co-parental relationships. So whether good or bad, doesn't matter what the co-parental relationships were. It was, you know, it was just bad, bad, and more bad. Medscape.com also has a really good article on this. Financial consequences become clear as separated parents must maintain two households with two sets of expenses on the same income as before the divorce. So obviously, it's going to be tough. In terms of expenses, there are going to be way more people on welfare. You know, hello, is there a reason why? We've got 92 million people outside of the labor force not willing to work. Is there any concern, any question as to why 153 million Americans are on government benefits? Anyway, only 50% of single-parent households headed by the mother have child support agreements from the father. I didn't realize that. Only 50%. That's low. Wow. 25% of the households with support agreements receive no money whatsoever from non-custodial parents.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, even though there's an agreement, are they even paying up?
They're not
up?
Even paying up.
Yeah.
So these poor children are suffering economically. Economic stress extends outside the house. Children are aware of their economic standing compared with those around them. Parental contact is also a casualty of divorce, something I never considered before. Wallerstein and Blakeslee found that an employed mother in a two-parent home is in contact with the children 25 hours a week. She's employed.
Even though she's employed.
Even though she's employed, she gets 25 hours a week with the kids. After the divorce, the number decreases to 5.5 hours a week.
Wow.
That's devastating. That's just devastating. A housewife has her 45-hour a week before the divorce decreased to 11 hours a week after the divorce. The employed father's hours, here's the father's hours, they decrease from 20 hours a week to 2 hours a week after the divorce. That's like nothing. That's a shot in the head of the family. Wow, you talk about destroying parental relationships with kids, friends, divorce, the breakdown of the parent relationship, the marriage relationship is devastating, devastating. And I know people are arguing whether it's 40 to 50%. Okay, so divorce rates at 40%, the shack-up rate's 10 times what it was in 1970 to compensate. So they're just not getting married. This is all resulting, this social disaster is resulting in an economic disaster of unbelievable proportions. You know, 156 million people in America on government benefits, 93 million can't work. And the character of the next generation of kids that grew up in these shacked-up households and divorced households, friends, okay, it's over. Western civilization is over. But how about rebuilding things? Let's rebuild things according to the principles of God's word. Let's bring the principles relating to marriage back into the church.
Strengthen what remains.
Absolutely. We're doing an I Still Do conference at our church here in Elizabeth coming up in October. People want a little more information, just go to reformationchurch.com. The I Still Do thing from Family Today.
Yeah, Family Life Today.
Yeah. We're doing doing a simulcast here in Elizabeth at our Reformation Church Elizabeth because we really believe these are the building blocks for, hey, entire socioeconomic systems.
Yeah.
Our marriages break down, we're done for. Kids are going to suffer. Their education's going to suffer. We brought that into a previous broadcast. Yeah, this is the fundamental issue, friends. We could talk about all the tertiary issues and stuff. We talk about how we can improve education, how we could dump another $60 billion in education in Colorado and, you know, fix these kids who've been through horrible, hellish conditions in their families through their parents' divorces and such. But if the parent-child relationship is done for, and the parent-to-parent, the marriage relationships are done for, there's no way we're going to salvage this society. So it's going to come back to the very basic principles of God's word. By the way, on marriage and on the basic responsibilities and roles within marriage, we've got a new book coming out called Keep the Faith, Volume 2, where we trace 2,000 years of Christian wisdom from the greatest Christians who ever lived on the issue of marriage, responsibilities of men to love their wives and wives to submit to their husbands, the roles within the homes. We've got that in Keep the Faith Volume 2, and this is going to be a land-breaking book that I think every family, certainly every church, needs to have. because with the breakdown of sexuality, family, marriage in the modern day, the church needs to stand strong, firm on these issues. They need to stand on scripture and the wisdom of 1900 years of Western, Eastern, Protestant churches on this issue.
Yeah.
Wow, there's a lot of data, friends. I pulled it together with a little help from Josh Suiso, my assistant. We pulled together a 150-page book called Keep the Faith, Volume 2. And part of keeping the faith will involve keeping the family in good shape.
Yeah, if you're reading the Bible and you come up with a brand new interpretation that's never been done before, you know, that's kind of ties into this. You go back. If nobody has ever thought this, you know, such as, you know, like divorce is okay, you know,
or homosexual marriage or fill in the blank, right?
Mm-hmm. If nobody has ever thought that before, then we're probably wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So the closer you can get back to Jesus.
And if you're part of a system, part of a socioeconomic system, part of a church, et cetera, that's compromising on issues like divorce, issues like homosexuality, fornication, adultery, what have you, you need to get back to scriptures. And I would encourage you to take a look at 1900 years of Christian wisdom on issues like family, sexuality, and marriage. These things available at our website, kevinswanson.com. Again, it's Keep the Faith Volume 2, available right now at our website, kevinswanson.com or generationswithvision.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.